Judiciary Committee. We apologize again this afternoon for our late start. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 564. So I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 564 and invite up Senator Atkinson. And you're a witness. We appreciate it. I'm getting my sheets here, so I don't have your name, sir. But if we start with the senator and he can introduce you, that would be just fine.
Chair Williams, Brother Max, members of the committee, thank you for having me. For the record, Jason Atkinson, state senator from Southern Oregon. And with me, and I'm surprised he's doing much better, because the first time we had this hearing in the Senate was in the morning, and he drove 4 hours up from Grants Pass in the morning. It was a little sleepier. But this is Corporal Jeff Gettings, who's an officer at the Grants Pass Police Department. And actually, he is the reason why we have this bill here before you. It's a bill that has gone through the committee process in the Senate. It's gone through quite a bit of change and then comes to you today. I'm not going to talk very much on the bill. I'd just like to hand it over to Corporal Gettings, and we'll take it from there. So,
thank you. Senator, do you want to stay for his testimony and then be available for questions, or do you need to leave?
I need to depart, if that would be all right.
Okay. We rarely get a member of the upper chamber to come down and visit us here, and so when that happens, we like to give our members a full chance to take a whack at them while they're here. Does anyone have questions for the senator before we allow him to depart?
Let me put my hands up, and you can hit me with a ruler. I'm ready.
Lord, old great one.
How does he feel about bioptics?
Okay, no questions. Thank you, Senator. We appreciate it.
Good luck.
Corporal Gettings, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Gettings. I am a corporal with the Grants Pass Department of Public Safety in Southern Oregon. I've been there for about 8 years. The reason I'm here today is to talk about Senate Bill 564, which is something that I feel really, really passionate about. Senate Bill 564 offers long overdue protection for law enforcement animals. And it basically makes a couple of changes to existing statutes. First, in order to be offered any protection under statute, a law enforcement animal must be termed as a police animal being involved in police work. Well, there are a lot of different law enforcement agencies out there that are using animals now to augment their staffing, especially in times of these tight budgetary times. And those animals are not protected because they're not meeting that particular definition. So the first part of this bill addresses that. It changes the term from police animal to law enforcement animal, which is more accurately describing the types of animals that are being used out there. And it also adds adult corrections, youth corrections, and parole and probation to the definition. Since these different law enforcement agencies either are now actively or will be very soon using animals to help augment their work out there. So that way it will cover all of the law enforcement animals that are used out there, not just the police animals. Secondly, in current statute, if someone was to kill or seriously injure a law enforcement animal, they would be charged with criminal mischief 1, which is a simple property crime. Criminal mischief 1 would be the same thing that I'd be charged with if I took a key out of my pocket and I ran all over your car and scratched the paint up. I would be charged with criminal mischief 1. If I was to go down to a payphone and break the handset off of the payphone, I'd be charged with criminal mischief 1. And I think it's crazy that someone that kills a law enforcement animal would be charged with the same crime. And I think lumping them into simple property crimes like that certainly sells the value of these animals short. I know they mean more to their handlers, certainly their law enforcement agencies, and absolutely to the communities that they serve. So what this bill does is create a separate law called Assaulting a Law Enforcement Animal. And the wording is very similar to the existing statute, with a couple of differences. In criminal mischief 1, it's a crime of intent. You have to show they intentionally committed this crime. Well, that's easy to do when someone takes a key out of their pocket and runs it all over a car. It's very easy to show that they intended to damage this. The problem with that is, in the dynamic situations in which law enforcement animals are killed, it's normally against some sort of focused, aggressive attacker that is armed. Law enforcement agencies show up, try and convince the person to give up. They don't. They bring in a police canine in order to apply a bite to this person, hopefully subdue them so that the law enforcement officials can come in and take them into custody. What happens, however, is the police canine will go in. The attacker will end up shooting, killing, or seriously injuring the animal. Now, it's very easy for that person to go into court and argue, well, criminal mischief one is a crime of intent. I didn't intend to kill this animal. It was just a byproduct of this struggle. He had my arm. The gun went off. I didn't intend to kill the animal. Nevertheless, the animal is dead. So what it does is it changes the level of proof from intentional to knowingly. They engaged in conduct that they knew would end in this result. And that's basically just one step lower than where it is sitting right now in criminal mischief one. The second thing it does is right now, if I was to scratch the paint on someone's car and I was convicted of that, I would be sentenced using the sentencing matrix as a crime category 6. And that basically stays the same, a class C felony, crime category 6. However, if someone kills or seriously injures a law enforcement animal while they are attempting to escape or they're actively resisting arrest, if they're convicted of that, it would bump them up to a crime category 8. And what that means is, if a person has no criminal history whatsoever, they would still have optional probation. But if a person has a violent history, a long criminal history, they would actually receive prison time, which I think is more indicative of the type of crime that they committed. That, in a nutshell, is what this is about, and I'm available for any questions you might have.
Are there questions for Corporal Geddes?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Corporal, I just want to set a record, and if you could elaborate a little bit more as to why the level 8 as compared to leaving it at the level 6, knowing that there can be enhancements based on the court taking in aggravating or mitigating circumstances.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, the reason I went that direction was simply to, you know, it's like the different degrees of theft. If someone takes something that is of a greater value or acts in a certain way, the penalties for their actions should be higher. And I think this is the same way. If they are killing an animal while they're also actively doing this other thing, I think the penalty should be higher. And I guess the argument there too is, if there are mitigating circumstances, they could certainly argue lower or higher from the crime category 8 as well.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So if I'm got this correct, for level 8, it would apply to anyone where the dog, in this case, would be not only killed but also injured?
Seriously. Serious physical injury. There's no crime right now for just injuring a dog or horse.
But I'm it says injury.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prozanski, Section 3 is serious physical injury, but to correct the Corporal Geddes, animal abuse in the second degree, which is a B misdemeanor, is a if you intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly cause physical injury to an animal. Physical injury is, you know, we got physical injuries and serious physical injury. Physical injury is substantial pain or impairment. Serious physical injury is protracted disfigurement, I'm going off the top of my head, or risk of death, and I'll get the full definition for you here in just a moment.
Do we have a sentencing guidelines here?
The cheat sheet?
The chart?
No, I don't know that I've got one with me. I'm sure if you walk in the judiciary office.
Yeah, I have a photocopy.
That'd be great.
That would work for you.
There are other questions while Representative Prozanski looks at this? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corporal Geddes, one thing you mentioned just in passing in your testimony I'd like to focus on for a moment. You mentioned that if a police animal were used to subdue a suspect, and what I'm wondering is if a suspect upon having a dog, I think the term you use is put a bite on a suspect. If an individual were confronted with a police animal who was attempting to do that, and were to do something to the animal in the, perhaps the belief that there was a, it was necessary for their self-defense, how would that impact this potential crime? That is, would a person be criminally liable without any justification if they were to do something to the animal to in the belief they were protecting themselves?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, I think something like that probably wouldn't even make it out of grand jury. If they could, if the person could show that they were acting in self-defense, it would probably never get to court that way. I think that the reason for this is for those people, again, that, and you know, and it's impossible to speak of the grand scheme of things, what may happen or possibly happen in, you know, in the future with each one of these situations, because they're so dynamic, they're so evolving. I think that if for some reason someone felt that they were acting in self-defense, they could certainly argue that. However, there are no police canines that are just sent in to an unknowing person. Police canines are always announced. They're always they're a tool that's used that is kind of a last resort. And as I said, generally what occurs is the police are there. They're trying to get this person to disarm themselves or to comply. And it is the suspect that forces them to go to that level of force. So there really would be no opportunity for them not to understand what's going on, not to give up initially. And if they went past all of that and a police canine was sent in, if they were to then kill the canine, then that's what this is designed to address.
Bob, you may follow up. Here's what I'm pondering is that I believe the law is that if a police officer is subduing you as a suspect, if I'm under suspicion of something and a police officer is subduing me, I have to submit to that authority and I have no right of self-defense against that officer. But if it were a police animal, I guess the concern I might have as a citizen is that the training and knowledge that an officer brings to the level of force necessary to the situation isn't one that I would necessarily assume the animal would be applying. That is, do I have a right of self-defense? And maybe your response assumes that I do have a right of self-defense that I wouldn't have against an arresting officer, for example. Do I have the right to, if I believe that an animal is going to cause me harm, then do I have a right to do something to the animal to prevent that? Or is it like is that animal really just an extension of the officer, where in effect I have no right to resist the officer if he's acting within his authority?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, that's kind of a tough one to answer. I don't know that that's been addressed by the courts, and maybe counsel could say that for sure. There's nothing in here that says the person needs to give up their right of self-defense. I guess my idea behind this is these are tools that are used well after the person has already established that they're not going to comply with police demands, that they're not going to comply with what's being asked of them, they're not going to disarm. And rather than send a uniformed officer in there to put their life in jeopardy, these police canines are being used as tools. And for them to then take the life of this animal, which is an extension, I suppose, of the police officer, is what this addresses. But there's nothing in this particular thing that addresses or takes away from their right for self-defense.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for the corporal? Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming forward. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 564? Okay, we'll close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 564. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 617. I didn't note that you were here, Mr. Attorney General, but we welcome you to the committee. Please come forward. And perhaps some of our questions about
assault against a law enforcement canine could be put to the Attorney General while he's here.
I think your capable staff is careful.
You don't want to go for Representative McPherson's self-defense question?
Thank you, Chair Williams and members. For your record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I appreciate this opportunity to present some comments as the committee takes up Senate Bill 617. And I'm appearing today in my capacity as Chair of the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force, which sponsored Senate Bill 617. The task force was formed to address an issue that has been a very serious concern for victims of crime in Oregon for a number of years. While Article 1, Section 42 of the Oregon Constitution provides a right to prompt restitution, our criminal justice system instead sends a very ambiguous message to victims about offender accountability for pecuniary damages suffered by victims. And this bill, in effect, seeks to fulfill the constitutional commitment that Oregon has made to crime victims. Under current law, when a person is convicted of a crime or a violation described in 153.08 that has resulted in pecuniary damages, the court, in addition to any other sentence it may impose, may order that the offender make restitution to the victim. And current law further provides that in determining whether to order complete, partial, or nominal consideration or restitution, the court shall take into account certain factors, most importantly, the financial resources of the defendant and the burden that payment of restitution will impose, taking into account the defendant's other obligations. The effect of this statutory statement of policy, to put it frankly, is that a significant number of victims are left without any restitution judgment whatsoever. Let me illustrate. A recent study by our Crime Victims Assistance Section examined 1,364 claims for victims' compensation that the Department of Justice accepted and on which it made payments in 2002. And in each of these cases, the defendant had been convicted of the crime for which the victim was seeking compensation. And of those 1,364 claims, 1,077, or 79%, did not have any restitution order. In some number of other cases, only partial restitution was ordered. And the total comp paid in those claims, by the way, was about $1,085,000. Whatever the reasons that may account for this tremendous gap in the awarding of or the entry of a restitution judgment, we think the most important is probably the court's assessment of a defendant's ability to pay. I think it's also worth noting that in the statewide crime victims needs assessment that was recently completed by the Department of Justice, 60% of the responding victims indicated they believed their right to restitution was not being enforced. 60% of the victims. In the assessment, many victims, key informants, and service providers indicated that they believed offender accountability is the area within the criminal justice system most needing improvement, and the collection of restitution was a key change identified by the respondents. To address the shortcomings of offender accountability for restitution under current law, this measure proposes a basic change to Oregon law. Under this measure, if the court finds that a person convicted of a crime or violation has caused pecuniary damages to the victim based on evidence presented by the district attorney, the court must enter a judgment that the defendant pay a specific amount of restitution that equals the full amount of the victim's pecuniary damages, or enter a judgment that the defendant pay restitution for the full amount with the specific amount of restitution to be determined within 90 days unless that time period is extended for good cause. Under the measure, restitution judgments are due and payable when the amount of restitution owed is entered. However, if the defendant alleges and establishes inability to pay the full amount, the court or other supervisory authority may establish a payment schedule taking into account the financial resources of the defendant and the burden that restitution payments will impose, given due regard to the other obligations of the defendant. So, in short, the single most important change made by the measure is that a defendant's financial resources would no longer be a factor in determining whether a restitution judgment will be entered in the first place if a victim has suffered pecuniary damages. That factor would determine whether the court or other supervisory authority allowed payment on an installment basis, to be determined by the court or other authority. The measure also creates a parallel mandate to enter restitution judgments for certain forms of loss in all juvenile court cases in which youth offenders are within the juvenile court's jurisdiction because of acts which are violations or which, if committed by an adult, would constitute a violation of law or ordinance of the United States, the state, a city, or county. Under the current juvenile code, courts are directed to consider restitution to be of high priority, and there is a rebuttable presumption that a restitution obligation is in the best interest of the youth offender. And this bill's mandate replaces that rebuttable presumption. The bill continues current law provisions that youth offender restitution for emotional or psychological injury, however, is to be imposed only when the conduct would constitute aggravated murder or a sex crime if committed by an adult offender. And for any injury suffered by the victim or a member of the victim's family who observed the act. And as with the adult offender restitution judgments of restitution against juveniles, youth offenders, are due and payable when the judgment is entered, but the court may establish a payment schedule when the youth offender alleges an inability to pay the full amount. And that schedule may be established by considering various factors, including the youth offender's financial resources and other obligations. To sum up, Mr. Chair and members, in 2001, there were approximately 42,000 person crimes and 242,000 property crimes reported in Oregon. Now, these offenses represent an immense amount of suffering and hardship resulting from physical injury. Assuming death hasn't occurred, physical injury, emotional and psychological injury, and loss or damage to property. Persons found guilty of causing such suffering and hardship should be under a strict legal obligation to make full restitution to victims. And the task force believes that such payment is also an important mechanism for offender rehabilitation and reintegration as a productive and law-abiding member of our society. And I would very respectfully urge the committee to give Senate Bill 617 its strong support. I might close by saying that Oregon is not alone in re-evaluating the position of the state in holding offenders accountable for financial obligations, and I'd like to ask Connie Gallagher of our Crime Victims Assistance Section to give you a very brief overview of Colorado's reform measures, which provide really the genesis of the work of our own task force, and I think are illustrative of reforms taking place in states throughout the country.
Thank you. Ms. Gallagher, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher, Director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. As the Crime Victims Assistance Section, we frequently are contacted by victims who express their unhappiness with our criminal justice system because they perceive it as a system that is not balanced, that fails to hold the offender accountable for harm, particularly in regards to the financial obligations such as restitution. As the Attorney General has said, we turn to other states to see what types of reforms they were making. So I'm briefly going to discuss a few of the changes that Colorado found to be useful and effective and share also how that compares with Oregon. To begin, Colorado passed a very clear, unequivocating policy statement. It reads, "The General Assembly finds and declares that crime victims endure undue suffering and hardship resulting from physical injury, emotional and psychological injury, or loss of property. Persons found guilty of causing such suffering and hardship should be under a moral and legal obligation to make full restitution to those harmed by their conduct." probably most of you in the committee are aware that the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 42, says a victim is entitled to prompt restitution. Our revised statutes go on to set forth factors that the court must consider when determining whether to order restitution. The court must consider the defendant's financial situation, the burden a restitution order will impose on the defendant, the defendant's ability to pay on an installment basis, and the rehabilitation effect on the defendant. In Colorado, the statutes provide for restitution orders to be final civil judgments that remain in effect until paid in full. Oregon's judgments simply expire after a period of either 10 or 20 years, depending on the type of judgment and the date of the judgment. Civil money judgments expire after 10 years unless the victim takes the initiative to renew that judgment. Colorado has initiated a system that utilizes collection investigators. These investigators conduct an in-depth assessment of assets. They set up payment schedules, and they monitor payments. They also impose sanctions for late payments or no payments. In Oregon, restitution may be ordered as a criminal money judgment or sometimes as a condition of parole and probation. But in neither case do we have an individual that is trained in the assessment of assets and charged with conducting an assessment of these assets and monitoring the payment. In Colorado, they had a system that was similar to Oregon's in that prior to having collection investigators, they had the judge and the clerk set up payment schedules. What they found was that this cost approximately four times what it costs to have collection investigators do this type of work. In Oregon, we do have probation officers that have the power to set up and monitor payments, but again, this is not an efficient way to conduct these activities, and certainly they don't produce the necessary results. And again, the authority of the probation officer or parole officer ends, of course, when the supervision period is over. In Colorado, supervision is not terminated until an offender has paid the restitution in full. In Oregon, the term of probation or parole is time-limited and generally ends regardless of whether restitution is paid in full. And generally, we're talking a fairly short period of time for probation or parole, approximately 5 years for probation and 2 years for parole. In Colorado, the collection agency cost can be added to the restitution judgment. In Oregon, this is not the standard practice. In Colorado, the Department of Corrections is required to withhold 20% of all inmate account deposits for the payment of restitution. In Oregon, the Department of Corrections is not required to do so. Looking at the effectiveness of collection efforts, again, the Attorney General shared some facts that we have from the business that takes place at Crime Victims Assistance. But looking a little bit more broadly at collection efforts in Oregon, we see that from July 1999 to December 2000, the Oregon courts ordered $32.4 million in restitution and fines. Payments only totaled $12.8 million during that period. And some of those payments were for judgments and fines that were from a prior obligation. So what we are looking at is a collection rate of somewhere less than 40%. In Colorado in the year 2002, offenders paid 80% of the total restitution ordered that year. But I want to say that even without collection investigators, there are some areas in Oregon that are able to do much better. Mr. Bill Jeffries is here in the audience today. He's a Multnomah County probation officer who was given a caseload of 180 offenders who were not making any payments at all on their restitution obligation. 180 offenders not making any payments. Within 1 year, he had 93% of those offenders making at least minimal monthly payments. Most restitution obligations are not large. The average in Colorado is between $3,500 and $5,000. And the average length of time it takes an offender to pay when they're closely monitored is 2 years. Oregon is probably comparable in terms of the size of the restitution. So this is just to remind us that if we choose, Oregonians can do more to hold offenders accountable and to recognize the harm that they cause victims and communities. This bill makes a small but important change in Oregon's public policy towards holding offenders accountable. Again, we ask your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gallagher. Ms. Byrd?
Good afternoon. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Arwen Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Survivors Advocating for an Effective System. We are a member-driven organization of crime survivors who seek a system of restorative justice. I represent our organization on the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. I am here today because SAFES believes that restitution is one of the cornerstones of a truly effective justice system. Restitution from offenders acknowledges the harm that was done. More profoundly, it represents responsibility for the injury caused by the crime, regardless of whether the damage was physical or emotional. Our current criminal justice system is very impersonal. Sometimes this is necessary. In most cases, the course of events amounts to an elaborate drama in which the primary players are lawyers. What might have begun as a very personal crime, an assault, a rape, a burglary, becomes another court case, the State versus John Doe. Throughout the process, punishment of the offender is the focus. Survivors are guaranteed the right to participate and have their voices heard, but the harm that was done to them is not the focus of the process. Very little is required that would indicate responsibility on the part of the offender. This bill represents important progress in our criminal justice system. By requiring that the full amount of restitution be paid, the state will shift the focus of the system back toward the harm that was done. This is an important step towards a restorative justice system for both survivors and defendants. My interest in this issue and the criminal justice reform generally stems from the fact that I was paralyzed by a drunk driver 10 years ago. At the time of the sentencing for the man who hit my sister and me, our hospital bills exceeded $300,000. Insurance only covered a portion of that bill, leaving $115,000 in costs that were ordered for his restitution. To date, my sister and I have been paid a little over $6,000, despite the fact that the man who hit us was part owner in a construction company, incurred huge amounts of credit debt, and owned at least 8 vehicles in the same time period. I won't belabor the details, but it has been 10 years of an uphill struggle, and there is no end in sight for me and my family. Needless to say, we are frustrated by a system that is not empowered to help get restitution to crime survivors. The amount of restitution that we are owed is unusual, but sadly the fact that we have not been paid is very common. Restitution should not impair a defendant's ability to live a normal life, nor should it impair his or her ability to engage in his community after serving his sentence. It must simply be an acknowledgement of the harm that was done. We strongly support the fact that the payment schedule for a defendant be determined by their ability to pay. We also agree that the burden of that payment of restitution be imposed, be considered. Otherwise, restitution becomes more of a punishment rather than an acknowledgement of responsibility. Thank you for your time today. Restitution reform is not only near and dear to me, but the many survivors that I have spoken with about this issue, most of whom are not receiving their restitution. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bird. Mr. Dole.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. And Crime Victims United was proud and honored also to be part of the Attorney General's Task Force on Restitution. There were many different committees that, or subcommittees that worked on the task or on the restitution question. Actually, I worked on in the area of collections, but because that area has a price tag on it that would be fairly high, it was one of the areas that we didn't bring in front of the legislature this year. The restitution is like the unfulfilled promise for victims within the criminal justice system. In 1986, there was a statutory piece passed which called for restitution in the Crime Victims United initiative that the people passed that called for crime victims' rights. Again, in 1996, a crime victims' rights constitutional amendment was passed, which was thrown out on a technical basis, but it was repassed by the people in 1999. So the people have called for this, both statutorily and constitutionally, but there's one other piece to this. Accountability is not just a word. It's actually part of our Constitution because there's another piece that the people passed in 1996, Article 1, Section 15, that states laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on the principles of protection of society, accountability and responsibility for one's actions, and reformation. And we cannot truly hold people accountable, nor can we reform them unless they have to step up and meet all the terms for the crime in which they were convicted. And that, and part of that is the restitution, not only incarceration, probation, community service, but restitution or any combination of those. In my experience, since my daughter Lisa was murdered in 1992, I've worked in the last 9 years with hundreds of crime victims, and this is probably one of the number one issues with crime victims, is that they consider restitution to be a joke, and they consider that the offender views restitution as a joke also. I can tell you personally in our case that we received restitution, but it was received in the last week before the parole was over. So he knew he had to do this in order to meet the terms of his parole, and I can tell you that he was came from a very wealthy family and had more than enough to pay that restitution up front. So that's just maybe a snapshot of how these people look at restitution in some cases. But we support the bill. We think it's a good bill, and we encourage you to pass it out. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dole. Are there questions for the panel? Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions about restitution judgments generally. Are they docketed? Do they constitute liens on real property, for instance? Are they enforceable?
Sure, Williams. Representative Shetterly, yes.
So are they enforceable with through mechanism like judgment debtor examination and things like that as well?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, yes, I believe they are.
Okay.
Is that it?
No. The other question, I just, you know, it's the hard case, and I'm hearing you testify, the one that comes to mind is a juvenile case I had back in the dark ages when I did those things, and it was a boy who was engaged in some fire play in a warehouse in West Salem and burned the place down. I think the damage to the structure is about $15,000. He was 15 years old and a paper boy for the Statesman Journal. And I'm wondering how, had the court at that point been required to impose a judgment of $15,000 against a 15-year-old boy on what was the first venture and the first time he'd ever been adjudicated, whose source of income was as a paperboy. I'm not sure. I know that wouldn't have gotten paid off, and I'm just thinking how that plays out in his efforts over the term of that judgment to get himself a college loan, to move himself forward and improve his own position. I worry a little bit about the fact that this is mandatory and, in fact, apparently can't even be waived or discharged even at some later point in the term of the judgment. I see that the court has discretion to enter into a payment agreement, but, I'm just thinking that $15,000 judgment against that 15-year-old paperboy would not have benefited the property owner, and I don't think would have benefited him in the long term. And how do we accommodate those hard cases in this kind of a mandatory, proscriptive kind of system of restitution?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, I think the honest answer from the standpoint or perspective of the task force is that there will be some hard cases that an across-the-boards mandate of this kind will produce. But that the supervening or overarching principle is across-the-boards accountability. And whether there are further structural ways in which the youth offender's subjection to the judgment can somehow be further delayed or moderated while still remaining faithful to the basic principle of accountability, something certainly could be pursued, but it is the straightforward recommendation of the task force to you that that you establish for both adult and youth offenders the and across the boards principle of accountability, and then deal with the as we have tried to do here, proposed to do here, deal with the issues of ability to respond to that by the schedule in which that obligation is to be liquidated.
But if I can, that's almost the problem, though, in this case, when you've got a paper boy's wages, you're never going to liquidate that, and that judgment is going to be outstanding for, you know, a 15-year-old, in that case, for 10 years anyway, 3 years that you'd like to see somebody getting themselves back, making themselves productive citizens, and again, hopefully going to college and college loan. I can just see this becoming, in this case, disserving the broader public policy that we're trying to advance here. And I don't disagree with the premise of this. It just what concerns me is when we take away all discretion from the court, then we are guaranteeing bad outcomes and unintended consequences, aren't we, when we're disallowing judges from taking into consideration the impact of a $15,000 judgment against a 15-year-old paper boy. I mean, shouldn't there be circumstances where a court has the ability to look at that and weighing those considerations against accountability for a 15-year-old paper boy might be you pay $1,000 of it, but without necessarily tying a judgment around his neck that's going to impede his ability to reform himself and move forward and reestablish himself. Those are the concerns, I guess, I would have about this, especially in the juvenile area.
Go ahead, Mr. Dole, and then Ms. Byrd.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I think that one of the things, at least the way I read the bill and see this, and that does happen, is that you've got changing circumstances. And so you've got that paper boy who, I don't know what this, I remember what I made as a paper boy, that was longer ago than I'll admit to. But I circumstances change. He does go to college. He gets out of college. He gets a good job. The judgment is still there. And in changing circumstances, he can meet more of that obligation. Or at least that's the way I would see it.
Ms. Byrd?
Mr. Chair. Representative Shetterly, I think I would just like to weigh in on your perspective of whether or not this is kind of like a ball and chain that he's going to carry with him for the rest of his life. And I would urge, us to look at restitution differently, that this is part of his rehabilitation. All of us are responsible for our decisions, and that it is ultimately restorative for him to be held accountable, but more importantly, to accept responsibility for those choices, and recognizing that some of us, you know, as a survivor, I'm dealing with the effects of the crime for the rest of my life, and so would the owner of the warehouse that he burned down. So it's not, I think that we should take into account more of a long-term perspective and kind of, as a society, helping him become a better citizen. That's a perspective that I take.
Okay. Anybody else? Any other questions for this panel? Have you had an opportunity to look at the Dash 82 amendments? I'm interested in your thoughts on those. The Dash 82 amendments were a concept that one of the folks who came to talk to us about this bill or came to talk to me indicated a concern as to someone, for example, who was totally disabled as defined by the statute. Somebody who would be unlikely, obviously, to be in a situation to ever fully make restitution based on the fact that if they're totally disabled, they're likely receiving Social Security or some other sort of a government assistance, and whether or not it would be appropriate in those circumstances to allow that consideration. So the A2 amendments were drafted to attempt to address that issue. I'm interested in your response to that point and whether or not you agree or disagree that that's an issue that the committee ought to be considering as they address this issue. Whether or not the task force has had an opportunity to consider that as well.
Chair Williams, I don't recall that the task force specifically considered permitting more individualized treatment of offenders based on X or Y factor. I think we talked about that at least as a principle, and I think I can truthfully represent to you and to the committee that it was the, I think basically the, essentially the unanimous view of the task force that accountability should be the foundation principle across the whole spectrum of offenders. There ought not to be any categorical exemptions, if you will, from that principle. And that if and to the extent the ability to respond to the restitution obligation is affected by, well, any factor that legitimately can be recognized, whether it's disability or some other perhaps, that is taken into account in determining the schedule by which the obligation will be liquidated. And I think that that is, I think that is the right approach, and that's the one I would commend to you, Chair Williams, and to the committee. We've built that flexibility in here in relation to the schedule for liquidating the obligation while inviting you to establish as a basic principle of Oregon law that all offenders are going to be subject to the basic accountability, foundation accountability to begin with.
Definition of disabled that the amendment uses is 412.150, which essentially says a total disability is one which prevents performance of substantially all the ordinary duties of occupations in which a disabled individual is capable of engaging, having due regard to the training, experience, and circumstances of the disabled individual. I mean, so essentially, I think the definition is that this is somebody who essentially would be, you know, occupationally disabled. And I guess at that point, I wonder what the point of would be, at least in those very particular circumstances, of requiring someone to carry around with them, someone who is disabled as defined in the statute, that kind of a judgment obligation for sort of the remainder of their days.
Well, Chair Williams and members, two quick comments in response. One is, the existence of
I'm sorry, Mr. Attorney General, I was interrupted with a message. Do I need to be there? Okay. Thank you. I apologize. Please proceed.
The existence of a disability, even as defined in the statute you just quoted, doesn't speak to the question of the net worth of that individual. That individual may have substantial assets. Well, that's really the main point I wanted to make in response, that I don't think that it by any means fully accounts for the circumstances that bear on the ability to meet or not to meet a restitution obligation or the schedule by which it might be reasonable to expect that it be met.
Okay. Sure.
Yes. Go ahead.
No, I was going to let other members comment.
Just one question. Are restitution judgments subject to discharge in bankruptcy as well?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, could I confer with Mr. Boss? He is
sure.
Here.
My ask the boss.
I asked him to come over as a resource.
If you'd identify yourself for the record, Mr. Boss.
Yes. Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm Assistant Attorney General. I'm Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. Part of our division work is bankruptcy and collection work. And really, in answer to Representative Shetterly's question, Chair Williams and Representative Shetterly, it really depends on the basic nature of the debt. For example, if it is a car accident, right, that is specifically not dischargeable. If it's an intentional act, that's not dischargeable. If it's a negligent act, that may, under certain circumstances, be dischargeable. I don't know whether that's...
So the correct answer is that it all depends.
I would guess the predominant... Probably not dischargeable, since most are going to be intentional.
More likely than not, yes.
Okay. Further, Representative Ackerman, I'm still going to give you all a chance to respond here, but
Yeah, I think I have just two or three responses, and one is on the last question. It would, the dischargeability of the judgment might depend upon the findings made by the court in the entry of the judgment. Would that be correct? I mean, could you protect the record that way to so a person could determine whether the obligation was or was not dischargeable in bankruptcy?
Chair Williams, Representative, again, it depends. The bankruptcy court is not necessarily bound by the findings of the state court. They will, however, give deference to what the trial court finds.
I just have an observation, Mr. Chair, with respect to the examples forwarded by Representative Shetterly and the Chair. If this was a juvenile situation, a house burning down, and a civil situation, I don't think the court or the jury would be at least legally obligated to show any deference to the defendant in terms of court instructions or otherwise. I think also a disabled person, if we make an exemption here, would be my feeling that a disabled person may be judgment-proof anyway, depending upon the nature of compensation being received by that person. Is your experience that most disability payments, Social Security, workers' compensation would be exempt from execution?
Chair Williams, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything further? Anybody else want to respond before we bring up the next panel? Ms. Gallagher and then Ms. Byrd.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have some figures here that I thought you might be interested in regards to how frequently this problem is encountered. I did speak to someone in Colorado who indicated that it is very, very rare that he sees a defendant who cannot pay due to disability of some sort. In the thousands of cases that he's reviewed, he indicated perhaps there were one or two cases in his experience where a defendant or an offender legitimately could not make a payment. They feel very strongly that trust accounts, personal property, other assets frequently come into play in regards to this obligation. They have established what's called a bad debt recovery account, and if there is a genuine case where the defendant can't make the payments, they move the obligation into this bad debt recovery account. When I was speaking to Mr. Jeffries in Multnomah County, I asked him the same question, and he indicated that of roughly 350 cases, perhaps 8 or 10 of the defendants were on SSI or SSD. However, all of them were making regular monthly payments, even if only $5 to $10. And he did not recall a case where a person's disability caused the Department of Community Corrections not to pursue collections. However, there is another alternative. The order could be vacated should there be such a case, is my understanding as well.
All right, Ms. Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to comment on the issue of disability as well. Obviously, being a person with a disability, this is something that's near and dear to my heart, and I think I would just like to maybe bring to the committee's attention that there's a whole spectrum of ability within disability. As a paraplegic woman, I have the ability to work full-time is sometimes difficult because of you know, pain and my fatigue level and those sorts of things, but I do have the ability to work, and so I would urge the committee to recognize that just because somebody has a permanent disability doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have the ability to make some meaningful contribution.
Thank you, Ms. Byrd. Mr. Dole?
I'll make this brief, but there is one other issue that I think needs to be addressed here when it comes to people who are disabled, because I've had it come up a couple times in my experience in working with victims, and that is the person that becomes disabled because of the involvement in the crime itself. And I think that's something that can be considered, but I'd ask you to look at that very closely in considering the amendment. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Next up, Diane Ray and Helen Smith.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Helen Smith, Chief Deputy District Attorney, Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. Here in support of Senate Bill 617, I forwarded to you a letter from the Multnomah County District Attorney, Mike Schrunk, and we're here to indicate our support. As you know, in our work and the work of all the district attorney's offices throughout the state. We deal with victims on a daily basis, and we see the issues surrounding the various problems that are associated with being a victim, and restitution in our experience is one of the biggest issues that victims face, and they have a great deal of difficulty in understanding why it is that routinely they are not at least receiving an order for full restitution. They oftentimes see their offenders on the street, driving nice cars, engaging in other activities that everyday folks engage in, and wonder why it is that they can't at least make some payments or even be ordered to make payments. We've had good success with our probation department, as you might hear in a moment, in them making efforts to collect restitution when there is a focused effort made in that regard, and we've worked with them over the years to do that. I would just reiterate a few of the things that you did hear before, and that is that circumstances do change. In discussing this issue with our trial court administrator, Mr. Bray, he informed me that it is not unusual at all for them to have situations where title companies contact them to make the final payments or the full restitution payment for folks who have these judgments against them as they try and buy property. So even though at the time of sentencing the court may have looked at this particular offender as someone who may not be able to make full restitution, in fact, years later, in fact, that person can make restitution, and in fact, that does happen depending on what the court has ordered. We stand ready to answer any questions you have, but we are in strong support of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Ms. Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Diane Ray. I'm the chair of the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I was also the chair of the subcommittee of the Restitution Task Force that developed this concept for the bill that you have before you today. You've already heard the excellent summary of the impact and effect of this bill, and I won't repeat that. I will just tell you that we do support this bill. I agree with what you've heard in terms of court's inability to have accurate information at the time of sentencing about an offender's ability to pay, particularly offenders who go to prison. I think it is presumed by courts that if an offender is going to go to prison for 3 to 5 years, that there will be no ability to pay. And we know that offenders currently sentenced under guidelines can do anywhere from 12, 24, 36 months or longer on post-prison supervision. And I think we put courts in an awfully difficult position to say at this point in 6, 8, 10 years from now, an offender will not be able to pay. I have the ability to talk to inmates every week who are in prison and have been in prison for a long time. Some of them get out and will have very minimal ability to pay. Many of them, though, develop businesses in the institution. They get windfalls from inheritance or other means that just the court simply could not foresee. And so for those reasons, I think it is important to allow the courts to order restitution based on the amount that's been suffered, and then allow the restitution payment schedule to dictate how much is actually paid, if any, when the offender is released from the institution. We are, the board is the sanction authority for people who are on parole or post-prison supervision. We order as a condition of supervision restitution if an amount has been ordered by the court. We will not sanction or violate an offender who's been ordered to pay restitution if they do not have the ability to pay. And that's one of the reasons that I would testify against the -A2 amendments. We simply will not sanction an offender for whatever reason if they do not have an ability to pay, if it's disability or some other reason. I would urge you to look at page 2. Well, I have the A engrossed bill, but on the bill I have, page 2, lines 9 through 13, the law directly addresses this ability to pay issue and allows the supervising authority to set a payment schedule, taking into consideration the financial resources of the defendant and the burden that payment of restitution will impose for anybody, and not just for those who have a disability as defined by statute. And I think that is a more appropriate approach. Those are my comments. I urge your support and would be glad to answer any questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Are there questions for either Ms. Smith or Ms. Ray? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This just kind of popped into my mind, but there's a couple of issues. One is the incarcerated's ability to pay. I think one of the things that we have to remember, too, is that the incarcerated are working while they're in. And so wouldn't the court be able to say, for example, like in Colorado where they designate 20%, that they could, that the court could order the Department of Corrections to take a particular percentage of what they make as in their inmate work and put into a restitution account that then would go to the crime victim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, I'm not sure about the legal ability of the Department of Corrections to actually take money or awards that they are giving offenders. And since it becomes the offender's asset, the department's ability to actually take that from them pursuant, or the court's ability to order that. I certainly think that it has a lot of merit, but I don't know the actual legal ability of that. I'm sorry.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
With regards to juveniles and their ability or inability to pay, but is there in the case of a juvenile, is there a responsibility of the parents to pay part of or all of the restitution if a juvenile offender is ordered to pay restitution to a crime victim?
Chair Williams, Representative Krummel, not in a direct sense. There are some statutes on the book, as I understand it, one in a civil sense where a parent can be held responsible for an intentional tort of a youth, and I don't know what the amount is anymore. It used to be $2,500. I think it's greater than that. And also in this bill, there's reference to the, I can't remember what it's called, the failure to supervise a child, I guess it is. And in that sense, if a parent is responsible for that and doesn't meet any of the requirements for a defense, the parent can be responsible for some of the cost of the damage caused by the child.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Finally, Susan Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We're here in opposition to Senate Bill 617 as it's currently drafted. While we're very sympathetic and agree with the importance of restitution being imposed in the vast majority of cases, and that perhaps the court has too much discretion at present, the response of eliminating all court discretion, we think, is problematic. There are a number of circumstances, in our opinion, which will lead to harsh results. Representative Shetterly has described a juvenile case, and I also want to highlight the kinds of cases that the Dash A2 amendments address. And those are circumstances where the defendant has a permanent disability, either physical or mental. This is a particular problem, and I can give a couple examples. I'll actually give one example. In the types of cases where the courts, I think, are exercising their discretion to reduce or not impose restitution, where there are permanent mental or physical disabilities that will make the defendant incapable of ever working. This is a particular problem at present when we see each year more and more of the mentally ill being processed through the criminal justice system as opposed to the mental health programs, which are under cuts, under pressure, and are less and less available. It's a huge problem throughout the state. It's a huge problem in Multnomah County, where I've had most of my experience. To impose a significant amount of restitution in a case where somebody, for example, is mentally ill and would never be able to pay any amount or any reasonable amount towards that restitution judgment is really setting up the individual for a complete failure and has huge consequences on that individual's ability to proceed forward. I give an example of a case. So we're talking kind of in abstracts of people's ability to pay. It's sort of hard to sort of put grips on it. But this is the type of case that I'm talking about, and I think that the Dash A2 amendments address. An individual in Portland who had was a schizophrenic, was on permanent disability, had been able to work in the past, but had, you know, schizophrenia had sort of plagued him from the age of 30. Permanently incapable of working, was in a delusional state, was living in sort of a halfway apartment building that was catered to people with disabilities, particularly mental disabilities, in a delusional state, believed that the CIA was coming to rescue him by helicopter from his apartment window, and that in order to be able to be evacuated by the CIA, he needed to burn his personal belongings and eliminate all DNA traces. And started a small fire in his apartment, which was put out quickly by a sprinkler system. The damages in that case were enormous. They were something in the field of $25,000 because there was a huge amount of water damage. All, I believe, but $1,000 of that was covered by insurance. That individual went through a huge amount of trauma at the mere prospect that that amount of restitution would be awarded against him, to the point where that was all he could focus on. The court, under those circumstances, awarded a minimal amount. I believe that the amount of money that the actual property owner was out of pocket, that with the deductible, let's say $1,000, which the defendant, you know, could pay on a reasonable basis over a long period of time, but not the $25,000, which would have been impossible through that individual's life expectancy. I think when there's testimony about the Oregon system and testimony about caseloads in Multnomah County, where people are making on SSI and are making payments, there's a real difference about somebody making a $5 or $10 or $15 monthly payment on a restitution amount where it's the out-of-pocket expenses to the victim as opposed to a huge amount of insurance. Sometimes when we're talking about people with disabilities, particularly mental illness, it is a case in which we will have, you see, a lot of people in arson cases are people that set these fires in these sort of scenarios like I've just described, not intending to do a number of damage, but damage occurs. So I think that when we're talking about how it works at present, and it works, you know, fairly well, it works fairly well with the disabled because the courts have discretion. And it's my experience that when we're talking about people with permanent disabilities, this is the type of case where the courts are using their discretion wisely. And so we urge you to adopt the -A2 amendments. It doesn't require the court to waive. It simply allows the court to waive. It allows the court to either waive restitution or reduce restitution. When we're talking about future ability to pay or the defendant's wealth, that's certainly a circumstance that the court would take into consideration. I would find it very unlikely that a court, when they're given the discretion to waive, would not impose restitution if the person was disabled but came from a wealthy inheritance or had a huge amount of money either presently or in the future available, which is a matter a court could inquire into, and I'm certainly the district attorney would present to the court. So we believe that the -A2 amendments address a very, very a small number of people, but for those people, a situation in which a huge amount of restitution being imposed can create significant damage and impair their ability to get out of the criminal justice system, to disengage from criminal behavior, and to stay focused on the problems that they have with their disabilities, with their mental health treatment, and staying on their prescribed medications.
Thank you, Ms. Russell. Are there questions for Ms. Russell? Representative Ackman.
Yes, I just wonder if you don't find it it's ironic that a disabled criminal defendant, under your hypothetical, could obtain more mitigation in the criminal case, which would not be available to the same person in a civil case involving the same wrong. Isn't that ironic?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackman, I guess I would say no, because I think that the criminal justice system has other objectives that perhaps don't apply in the civil, and I think one of the primary ones is offender reformation and to reduce to the extent possible offender recidivism. So I think there are different objectives that apply in addition to making victims whole in the criminal justice system.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrill.
If I can, just in response to that, there is one aspect, though, as we learned today, of the criminal judgment. You can't discharge that in bankruptcy, which actually puts the criminal restitution judgment on a plane higher than a civil judgment. And you probably nobody would sue Ms. Russell's client in the first place in civil court because that person would be judgment proof. But if you got a judgment, they could take that to bankruptcy court, assume, and a civil judgment discharge that, which you can't do in a criminal case. So they're not entirely on the same playing field.
Further questions for Ms. Russell? Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 617? I was asked just earlier today by Representative Dalto. He has a constituent who would like to testify on this bill. But was going to be unable to be here today because of work requirements. And as an accommodation to him, I indicated that we would set this bill on tomorrow's agenda as well to allow that individual to testify before the committee. So we won't be taking the bill to work session today, but I would anticipate that we would take the bill to work session tomorrow. So the committee should prepare itself accordingly. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 617A. We're going to go back up now to the top of the agenda, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 342. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 342 deals with controlled substance, and it would allow prosecution of a person who is under the age of 21 who intentionally consumes a controlled substance for a violation of that crime, or excuse me, for a Class A violation, a person who intentionally consumes controlled substance. That's Section 1 of the bill. Section 2 would allow a juvenile who is so prosecuted, and then again, this is at a violation level, which there's no ability for probation for that. This would be a fine and certainly no incarceration. Section 2 deals with allowing such a person who has committed such a violation to do a diversion of that in juvenile court. And Section 3 and 4 deal with the technicalities of allowing that. And then in the later sections, Section 5 would allow such a person to also do a diversion if they are an adult, and then the judgment would not be entered.
Okay, thank you. We have both Sergeant Durbin from the Oregon State Police and Brian DeLashman. If they both come forward, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm, for the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. On this, we were the requesters of the bill through the Senate Judiciary Committee. Let me just give you a little bit of a history. Our members include not only line officers, but in many cases, we also have a mix of school resource officers, police officers fully sworn that work either in the facilities with schools on a permanent basis or on a part-time basis. And two of my board members are, in fact, school resource officers. And in brainstorming prior to the session, obviously I ask questions, as does the rest of the board, questions about what's going on out there, what is it that you need as far as tools to be able to do your job better, what kinds of situations are you seeing? And these two officers immediately piped up and said, well, the major problem we're having in our schools is drugs, and that we're having a hard time getting ahead of the curve in the schools. The pupils are way out ahead of us, and that they realize that if you come to school drunk, then we have the ability to cite them for minor in possession by consumption of alcohol. So they have now switched to marijuana or to speed or some other narcotic, knowing that there's no way to make a citation for that unless they have it actually in their possession. So the parallel that you have minor in consumption by alcohol does not have a parallel in statute, minor in possession by consumption of grass or some other narcotic. So I said, you know, I quizzed them and said, okay, well, what do you do in those situations? And they said, well, typically the kid gets kicked out for the day. You know, there's no follow-up, there's no referral to a diversion, there's no ability to get them into a program. In some cases, obviously, the parents are ignoring the situation or unwilling to get involved in the situation. So these kids come in and out of school on a regular basis. They're in for a while, they're disruptive, so forth. They take most of the resources of the school resource officer on a yearly basis. The one in Tigard in particular, the officer that I talked to yesterday, who's one of my board members, said that he gets about 120 cases of these during the school year in one high school. So it's pretty rampant. So this bill was not brought with the particular direction of trying to come down hard on students that make these decisions. It was intentionally designed to be a violation, not a misdemeanor, not a felony, as a way to get somebody's attention, get them into a program, somehow direct them so that this behavior gets corrected before they go too far down a path that harms them for their lifetime or harms somebody else, or takes away, again, as I said, distracting the resources of the schools as they have them currently. And with that, I'm willing to answer any questions. That's kind of the background of the bill, and I know that the sergeant has a little more background in this particular area and probably can answer some of the technical questions. I know some of the questions that I've been asked is, isn't it very easy for an officer, obviously, to smell alcohol and know that a kid smelled alcohol, but how do you, in fact, know somebody is under the influence of marijuana or a narcotic? And I'm again, the technical question probably is best answered by the sergeant, but there are ways to do that, and there are officers that are trained that way. And school resource officers may, in fact, have some of that training, or they have access to people who have that training that can be called in on these circumstances. And with that, I'll let the sergeant do his presentation.
Sergeant Durbin.
Chair William, member of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police and currently in the Drug Enforcement Section. And we're here today in support of Senate Bill 342. As been stated, this bill would give law enforcement a tool to use for early intervention in juveniles that are consuming illicit substances. And I think it is critical because when I was out in Yamhill County and I managed a drug task force out in Yamhill County, I spent a lot of time with the schools out in that county, particularly with the administration, in doing drug education and meeting with the representatives of the school board and the superintendent and the different principals of the high schools and middle schools. What we found in that was is that they were very interested in pursuing a way to basically deal with these juveniles that were coming to the school, knowing that these juveniles had used controlled substances either by their admission or by other determinants through DRE program, officers trained in drug impairment, those types. But they absolutely had nothing or no ability, no tool to do anything with this child other than to send them home. In a lot of some cases, they were expelled. Some cases, they were, the school's resource officers were brought in, those type of situations. But they basically did not have a tool to deal with this juvenile. This juvenile would then show up the next day and be back in class the next day, and this was a repeated cycle over and over. This is a problem because there is a lot of studies that are coming out that show that I've written into my testimony here, and I'll read a few of them. The National Household Survey on Drug Abuse for 2001 showed that 56% of illicit drug users 12 years and older used only marijuana. Don studies showed that in between 1990 to 2000, there was a sharp escalation of emergency department admissions for marijuana and hashish, and that was 622% increase between 12 to 17-year-olds. Oregon is listed as one of the 10 states with the highest incidence use of marijuana among 18 to 25-year-olds. An estimated 11% of early-onset marijuana users, 14 years and younger, used psychotherapeutics in the past year, while only 2.9% of those initiating after 20 years of age did so. An estimated 6.2% of those initiating marijuana use before age 15 abused or were dependent on illicit drug, compared with 1.3% of those initiating marijuana use at age 21 or older. And an estimated 5% of those initiating marijuana use at age 14 or younger were recent heavy users. That means 300 days a year use, compared with less than 1% of those at onset 18 years or older. And so these statistics do show that without early intervention by persons in law enforcement, justice, or drug treatment programs, that there is a very high probability that many of these juveniles who come in contact with marijuana will move on to addiction or other illicit substances. Marijuana has been called a gateway drug. And what they're finding now is that not necessarily that marijuana causes the abuse of other illicit substances, but that juveniles that are predisposed to use marijuana, oftentimes without treatment or a diversion-type program, will then be predisposed to use other illicit substances such as methamphetamine or those type of drugs. These officers, how they're trained is most of the school resource officers and officers in the state go through a program that is called a Drugs That Impair program. That program is an 8-hour program. It's taught by officers that are either in the Drug Recognition Expert program, which I was an instructor for that program for a number of years. And that program basically gives the ability for the officer to look at a person, determine if that person is under the influence of a substance, and then narrow it down, is that alcohol or another controlled substance. That program allows a probable cause standard. So in other words, an officer on the street pulling a person over driving could arrest a person determining that they're under the influence of a controlled substance. In the school, a reasonable cause standard is used, but in order for the violation, you'd have a probable cause standard. So these officers that are school resource officers, if they're trained under that 8-hour program, which most of the officers in the state are, would easily be able to determine a probable cause standard that this juvenile is in fact under the influence of a controlled substance. If they had any doubt at all, which a lot of the officers will do anyway, they'll call in a DRE that's in the county, and there's DREs in almost every respective county in Oregon. I'm not sure if every county. And they call in a DRE and have them then do another evaluation on this juvenile. And that concludes my testimony at this time. I'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Sergeant Durbin. Are there questions for Mr. DeLashman or Sergeant Durbin? Representative Ackerman. Go ahead.
Been mentioned the testimony that there are officers that are trained to determine or detect what substance a person has ingested. That's not consistent with my experience. Can you give me some information on that?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, I'm not sure I understand your question consistent with your experience.
In Brian's testimony, I believe there's some references in our materials that there are officers that are trained to determine the type of substance controlled substances ingested by a person. I'm not aware of that in my experience. Can you help me?
Sure. Representative Williams, Representative Ackerman, officers, when they go through what's called the standardized field sobriety training, in that training they have training for DUI impairment. Now, DUI can be either DUI alcohol or DUI drugs. In that training, they look for specific roadside tests that would evaluate a person to determine if they're under the influence. On these tests, there's a different categories of measurement within these tests, and then they determine if, in fact, the person is impaired. In that situation, let's say a roadside situation, what they would then do is bring that person back to a police station, and they would take and do a breath test. If the breath test determined it was zero, they would call in a DRE. However, on the roadside, under the DUID program, the 8-hour Drugs That Impair Driving program, there's different, in the statute, there's different areas of testing that they're allowed to do. And in that testing, they can actually, at a probable cause standard, arrest a person that they believe is under the influence of a controlled substance. Now, they will not narrow that down and say that person at that time is under the influence of a particular type of drug, but a drug category, yes, they will.
Thank you.
Representative Posansky.
Thank you. I understand the goal here is for early intervention. I'm wondering if either of you can tell me what schools currently have in place in the way of classroom instructions, programs, or other type of symposiums or seminars regarding the use of controlled substances and how it can impact their lives.
I can speak, Chair Williams, Representative Prozanski, I can speak to Yamhill County. I did a lot of work out there. And I can tell you, before I started that program, there was not a lot of concentration on being able to do a whole lot. And the concern was, if I back up and start with the teachers, the teachers had a great concern because that if a lot, some of them were actually in fear of some retribution from the students themselves. That if they,
sure.
Yes.
I guess I wanted to stay on the point of some questions I've asked. And so, Sergeant, if you know, that'd be great. If you don't, we can accept that as well. As to whether or not they have programs that are available through PE, health ed, or any type of programs that actually address these issues that we're concerned with to get information to these young people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I'm not aware. I mean, I'm not an expert in what goes on in each one of the school districts, but from what I've heard from the resource officers, it depends district by district, and as the squeeze is on at each school district, their ability to do anything other than some very basic educational stuff is severely hampered. But I think even under flush times, there is very little as far as other than probably as a component of a phys ed class or a health sciences class, discussion about narcotics or about marijuana. But with that said, I do know that the officer yesterday from Tigard, who did have a discussion with you about how he intervenes and how he tries to get these children in the system, may be at least somewhat unique. He's a school resource officer. He does attempt to have some intervention, some education with those students, but they just don't have the tools, but they don't have the sanction. And so in most cases, it's the upfront attempt to have an education, and then if it's ignored, then they have no ability to follow up and hopefully get some of these students into some kind of a program.
Further questions?
Yes.
Representative Przanski.
So if our goal is to get information to them, is it your position that the only way that we're going to be able to do this is to give tools to law enforcement to force students into the judicial system to make the impact that we're trying to reach by through this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I don't know that that is the only thing that we're attempting to do, but one of the things that, again, I'm being told is that there is a major tool that is not in the toolbox of the schools and the resource officers in order to get somebody's attention. Again, we are not looking at a criminal sanction of a misdemeanor or a felony. We are specifically talking about a violation here.
Well, wasn't it true that you can't have a misdemeanor or a felony because of what the current law is regarding status of marijuana at less than an ounce is limited to a violation in this state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, we could have written this statute or had this statute written that this level was anything, regardless of what the existing statute was on possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. What we attempted to do here was get the lowest level of sanction that we could look at, not only for the purposes of fiscal, knowing that we didn't want to have a tremendous fiscal, but also if in fact the goal is to direct some of these students into some programs, it was unnecessary to go a heavier sanction than that.
Can you please share with us why you believe a fine of up to $600 would be appropriate in getting compliance?
Well, again, in the drafting of the legislation going through legislative council, they were attempting to find the best place for this to kind of be housed without creating a whole new section of statute that happened to be what, in fact, less than an ounce was. I'm open to a suggestion from this committee, if that's the direction they want to go, that they want to create a whole new section with a whole new fine structure, that's not a problem for me. Again, our goal is to direct these students into a program so they can get some help.
In my discussion with 4J, which is out of Eugene, my understanding is that they don't think they have a problem with being able to actually have access to programs. They don't have the dollars to actually get young people into these type of programs or to have some of the teaching. Do you believe that maybe this legislature should consider putting money into those type of programs and allowing it to stay at the administrative level of the schools instead of getting them into the basically the criminal justice or the juvenile system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, far be it from me to suggest where the state should be spending their dollars or the local jurisdiction should be spending their dollars. I'm an advocate and have always been, for fully funding alcohol and drug programs, both for juveniles and for adults. I have other clients that have an interest in that particular area. I believe that we should be spending more money in that those particular fields. I wouldn't argue with you on that particular point.
And during your research, have you determined what burden this may have on county youth authorities, specifically using your example of your one officer had 120 cases, of putting that into the system to require the county youth authority to deal with that level of intake?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prusansky, no, I have not done those numbers.
And do you know what the current availability of diversion programs, understanding this, the status that we're currently in, that would even allow individuals to be referred to those type of programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prusansky, no, I haven't done that research.
And do you know what the cost may be for those type of programs, for the assessment and the treatment as required under the statute, under the bill as it's proposed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prusansky, I assume there's a fiscal along with this bill. I assume that they obviously took those factors in consideration.
Sergeant, did you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prusansky, if I could, I think that with this, if this were in place, that there would be a substantial amount of citations issued. However, I think that from what I've talked with school resource officers and from the schools that I've dealt with around the state, that if the, in fact it was known within the schools that there was some mechanism for dealing with the usage of marijuana or other substances, that there would be a lot less of that usage within the schools. Right now, there is no recourse for the administration other than sending the child home and the child coming back. So I think that if there was the knowledge to the students that, in fact, if they come to school and they're under the influence of a substance, that there would be some price to pay for that, basically being given a citation, put into a diversion program, that there would be a lot less of it. Also, within this bill, it does have the piece in it, intentional, which means that that student would have to admit to the usage or be found to be observed using and then be found to be under the influence. So that in and of itself is going to limit the number of students that are being, at this time, when a school resource officer has a student or is called to where a student is, and they believe that that student is under the influence, the school has a prerogative because it's a lower standard under the reasonable cause just to send the student home. A lot of times those students are not admitting to the usage. I'd say the majority of the time they're not admitting to the usage, and the school resource officer has not seen that student using the substance. So this there would not be that amount of students into the system.
Chair.
Representative Prusansky.
I'd like to follow up on the offense, the elements of the offense, looking at what's called for on page 2, on lines 20 through 20, looks like through 25, as to how this is established. I'm wondering, it sounds to me that you're proposing or would assume that we're going to potentially have DREs, meaning coming off the road or being called in off on overtime to go to the school to assist a resource officer. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prusansky, no. As I was stating, that officers, when they go through, the majority of the officers, I would say, in fact, all of the officers with the Oregon State Police, I'd say any of the officers that go through the standardized field sobriety training, within that training, there's a piece called DUID, driving under the influence of drugs. That encompasses the eight-hour piece where these officers are trained to a level of a probable cause standard. So the school resource officers, if they've had that DUID training, would be capable of fulfilling the obligations under this law, of looking at the juvenile and determine if they are, in fact, under the influence.
I'm going to ask you to walk me through an example, because of my caseload that I see that come through with DUIs. I know what they have to do when they actually get them to the station, as you stated, mm-hmm. and they blow a 00. Mm-hmm. They are bringing the DRE to actually demonstrate or to document them being under the influence. What I'm hearing is in the field, in this case in the schoolyard or in a school room, potentially these students are going to be a subject to field sobriety tests. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prusansky, they will not be subject to a full-blown field sobriety test. There are tests that officer will be doing to determine a probable cause standard for under the N funds.
HGN?
Yes.
And are they going to be doing any of the other type of multitask test?
Yes.
And what would those be?
Well, those tests would be, what they'd be doing is looking at the eyes, determining different things about the eyes. It would be asking them to perform a standing up and tilting their head back, doing a time test.
Romberg's.
Yes.
If I could, Representative, let me just make an announcement. Given the length of the examination here, I think we're going to finish this bill, and the bills that are currently listed that we haven't gotten to today will be carried over on tomorrow's judiciary calendar. Given the fact that we're under 24-hour, or we're not under 24-hour notice anymore, one-hour notice, we don't have a problem in posting those bills for tomorrow. So for those of you who are hanging around for other bills, we're likely not going to get them today. If you want to continue to sit and listen to the conclusion of this bill for entertainment purposes or otherwise, you're welcome to stay, but I wanted to let the rest of you free if you need to be free.
Does that include us, Mr.?
No, you have to stay.
Sorry, y'all.
Does that include the jury?
Yeah.
The jury can leave.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pazanski, if I could just expand on that a little bit. When officers, oftentimes officers that arrest an individual for driving under the influence, if they determine at the roadside that they believe this person, and oftentimes they'll believe this person is under the influence of a controlled substance other than alcohol, they'll make the arrest. The procedure is to take them back to have them blow an intoxilizer. And then we ask, it's a request more than anything, that they have a DRE come in and do a full-blown DRE evaluation so that they have that to back it up in court. However, I'd say a good majority do not have the DRE come in. And a good majority will then testify in court based on just their training from the DUID portion and testify in court that way. And we, in this situation, would we believe that a DRE would be the best person for coming in and doing the evaluation? Yes. Do I believe that that is going to be the case the majority of the times? No. I think that the school resource officers would, if they're not already trained in DUID, they would become trained in that, and they would use those tools to do the evaluation.
Will urine test be used?
That is not part. I cannot testify to that.
That's a means to determine types of drugs that someone may be exposed to.
Under the DUID program, however, we're talking about a school program here, and I believe that would be up to the school, Representative Mendez.
And then the part about under the influence, looking at the bill, it says the person is under the influence, and it says that as used, consumption also means inhaling of marijuana smoke. Can you tell us on what criteria it's going to be used? I mean, I'm looking as a prosecutor as to these cases coming forward to be prosecuted. I know on a DUII, if someone is basically coming in to testify, meaning an officer, limiting their knowledge as to what they observed without the DRE, if we don't have an alcohol below, more than likely those cases are not going to be going forward because it's the difficulty of proving beyond a reasonable doubt. So if you could help me out, how you think that these cases would actually be able to bring the proof forward that would be necessary to hold someone in violation of the law.
Chair Williams, Representative Pazanski. I can just testify from experience. I don't know in what jurisdiction that you're talking about. From experience, though, as an instructor within the DRE program, we had difficulty in officers requesting a DRE to come in and do the evaluation. And oftentimes we'd hear at the end of the case or the adjudication of the case, in fact, that a DRE did not come in. So I can testify to the fact that I do know that there are cases throughout the state that are being prosecuted by officers other than DREs in these cases. And I believe from my training experience that officers using the tests that they're trained in doing would be able to, in fact, be able to have this stand up? Yes, I do. In fact, that's what I would teach when I was out, again, in Yamhill County working with the schools in there. I would teach officers that were not DREs to be able to do these evaluations and that it would hold up in their reasonable cause and probable cause standard.
Okay. We're gonna whoa there, Representative. I've got two other witnesses that I want to bring up and allow to testify. And if you've got additional questions, I encourage you to ask them these individuals off the record, but I want to get the rest of the witnesses testified.
Thank you.
So, thank you. We'll bring up Susan Russell. Thank you.
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're here in strong opposition to Senate Bill 342, which we think, I think as Representative Przanski has highlighted with some of his questions already, really is adopting the completely wrong approach here by making this a violation rather than approaching treatment in a more direct way. If the treatment is really the purpose, as the proponents here claim, there are a number of consequences and inconsistencies that would result if this bill were passed. First of all, an individual who was convicted of a violation, that's the new Class A violation that would be created by Senate Bill 342, would be ineligible for any financial aid under the federal guidelines. Federal guidelines apply for a conviction for a violation as well as the crime. So rather than getting these kids into the treatment and moving them on, you're going to disqualify automatically any of these individuals that are prosecuted for a violation under this new violation that's created from any financial aid ever. We really feel that this is a completely wrong approach. Prosecuting the kids in the school based on these sort of partial examinations or passing, I would say, physical observations of their eyes or of their behavior. Representative Przanski has already highlighted the proof problems. There are the issues in terms of the invasions of these kids' privacy at school, in terms of rather than getting kids to come forward and be frank and be open about their problems, to have sort of the DRE officer parading through the halls in the school and having kids, I think rather than being more forthcoming and engaging in treatment, which is what we want them to do, to have them perhaps be hiding or to be less available and less frank, less open in their abuse issues to the extent that they're developing. In terms of the inconsistency that would be created here, under Oregon law, the case law provides that possession does not include consumption. So if someone has ingested ingested a drug, including marijuana, they are not in possession of it. The case law being is that in order to possess, you have to be able to exercise control over the substance. That is a statutory interpretation. I do not believe it's a constitutional. While the legislature would be free to change that, we do have this inconsistency where an individual who possesses through consumption at the age of 21 be convicted of this violation, whereas at the age of 21, possessed through consumption is not a crime. So not a crime, not a violation. So I think you would have disparate treatment challenges, and it would be an inconsistency that really doesn't have a rational basis. We strongly support that the best approach to reducing use and abuse of drugs, including marijuana, is through classes, treatment, and programs. Fining kids $600 for this new violation when the state is essentially bankrupt in terms of being able to provide and fund existing programs seems to us to be a real misplaced priority for this committee. We would encourage any amendment that would eliminate the violation and would put in its place simply the availability or the encouragement or, however you want to phrase it, of getting kids engaged into treatment rather than trying to create a violation, charge the kids, and provide that they then would be eligible for these diversion programs, which currently really aren't available and aren't well-funded.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Russell. Mr.
Fedanke. Mr. Chair, David Fedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, also testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 342. Only a couple of things I want to add, Mr. Chair. First of all, I have to tell you that this bill is one of those situations where I feel like we're rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. We're currently faced with a budget crisis that I know you all are much more familiar with than I am. We have been trying desperately through litigation to try to reverse some of the funding cuts in the criminal courts to allow once again the prosecutions of all non-person misdemeanors and many Class C felonies to proceed from the state of limbo in which they currently find themselves, both prosecutors, defendants, and victims. It seems to me this is not an opportune time to be talking about increasing the burden on the criminal justice system with a new offense. I strongly support what has been said here this afternoon in terms of trying to get kids into treatment programs. We believe that there are many, if not the majority, of school districts around the state that are already aggressively enforcing their own school rules against students who are using unlawful drugs in the school setting and in many cases outside of the school setting. And that, you know, there's already programs in place to carry that out. What is missing are the funds to allow schools to do more of that, to have counselors that actually can intervene and follow up with kids. It's a rare school these days that has counselors available to do that work, particularly below the high school level, where it's it may be most needed. And finally, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out for the committee that one of the disabilities for a long-term lobbyist in this building is to have seen and heard virtually everything before. And I remember when, in 1989, the bill was passed by this body to create what is now ORS 475.999, which is the penalty for manufacture or delivery of a controlled substance within 1,000 feet of the school. That, which imposes a Class A felony for delivery or of most controlled substances, already makes it a crime, a Class C misdemeanor, to deliver less than an ounce of marijuana on school grounds. And yet, the previous witnesses in support of this bill have told us that none of the laws that are currently on the books have provided the tools that are necessary to stop the rampaging epidemic of marijuana use in our schools. And with all due respect, Mr. Chair, I would submit to you that this bill isn't going to make a difference on a hill of beans either. Thank you.
Let me just ask this one question before we adjourn. To the extent right now that you can identify and prosecute minor in possession for someone who has consumed alcohol, I mean, doesn't it seem like there ought to be some degree of symmetry, recognizing that perhaps the controlled substance statutes cut a broader swath than you're interested in cutting, but ought there not be some symmetry for someone who is also in possession via their consumption of that kind of a substance on school grounds? So to the extent they can currently cite MIP by a school resource officer for somebody who's showing up drunk at school, why ought it be a different standard for somebody who's showing up high? Can you explain to me what the rationale for having a different standard between those two provisions of the law would be?
Mr. Chair, I guess a couple of things. One, in terms of the collateral consequences that would apply, being a minor in possession of alcohol does not affect someone's financial aid eligibility.
Okay. And Susan, I understand the collateral consequences. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about just the fundamental concept of someone who has either ingested a minor who is illegally ingested alcohol, or a minor who has illegally ingested a controlled substance, barring mm-hmm. not the collateral consequences of what it means to be a controlled substance, mm-hmm. but can you give me any kind of a policy or practical distinction why there ought to be a difference in trying to address, or a law enforcement officer's ability to address, a minor in possession through consumption
versus a minor in possession of controlled substance. Is there any rationale to distinguish between the alcohol and the drugs?
Mr. Chair, I think there are. I think one of the ones that comes quickly to mind, at least to my mind, is that when we're talking, and I think this is the what the proponents are saying, is that marijuana is a problem that can lead to other things. Our position with dealing with drugs, illegal substances, is that it is not okay for the juveniles to be engaged or people under 21, nor is it for adults. And therefore, the intervention should be to get people into treatment or get them counseling so that they abstain completely, not that they wait till they're 21 and they learn to drink within reason. When we're talking about minors in possession of alcohol, what we're saying is that it's not an unacceptable use or substance. It's simply that they're too young, and we don't want them drinking until they're 21. I think that there is a difference. We're not talking a minor possession of getting kids into alcohol treatment necessarily, or that they have an alcohol problem, simply that they're deemed by society too young to be experimenting and using alcohol. Whereas I think with this, what we're talking about, and the proponents are coming here with these statistics, is in terms of the number of kids that are engaging and the statistics in terms of their use of illegal substances. I really think it's a different thing in terms of the treatment, in terms of avoiding long-term.
But in fact, Susan, don't we on MIP attempt to use the resources to try to get kids into a better understanding of the relationship to drinking and determine whether or not, in fact, they do potentially have an alcohol-related problem if they're showing up at a school drunk? I mean, isn't that part of what that whole idea of being able to cite minor in possession on school based on consumption is, to try to engage that whole resource network to try to address the issue of kids whose judgment is so fouled up that they're coming to school drunk?
And Mr. Chair, that might be part of the purpose. I wouldn't say, and I wouldn't represent, that it's a program that works well if that's in terms of achieving that objective. My experience in seeing or dealing with minors in possession is they come in as a violation, they're unrepresented, they're imposed a $250 fine on the spot. They plead to the violation, they pay their fine, and so be done. I don't think it is a very good source to get kids engaged in treatment. It is, and particularly today when courts are busy, this is talking when the courts were less busy, they are processed in a very rapid, matter-of-fact way. These kids aren't on probation. They aren't engaged in any kind of, you know, overview. They don't have anyone that they're engaged with in the system that they can go to or talk to and that kind of thing. So I don't think that creating a violation and having a fine in a court system that doesn't have the time and doesn't have the luxury to accommodate is going to do anything other than have kids processed and pay a fine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shirley.
Oh, well, I was just going to respond to the distinction between the two, and Susan touched on it, I guess, and that is that you have MIP because, well, the minor, the status element there is significant because when you turn 21, it's legal to drink alcohol, and you don't have that.
Even at 21, it might not necessarily be legal to show up drunk at school.
However. Oh, well, but we're not. The bill doesn't really address school. No, the testimony was about school, but the bill addresses all circumstances. I was just. And I thought it seems to me to make sense to all of the resource issues aside and what have you. It seems to make sense to me to draw some consistency between those. And I'm just wondering whether, in my look at it, whether it makes sense to limit it to minors, since the consumption issue, you know, extends beyond the age of 21 for the purpose of whether it's legal or illegal to possess.
There's been discussion about just limiting the impact of this bill solely to juveniles under 18, but that's been one comment. Mr. Fedanke, and then we're going to...
Quickly. Mr. Chair, thank you. In response to your question, it seems that although the language of the bill is not limited to marijuana, it seems that the proponents of this bill are primarily concerned about marijuana use. And I would submit to you that one of the problems with deterring use of more serious drugs than marijuana by young people is cognitive dissonance. Young people know that marijuana is not as dangerous as cocaine. It is not as dangerous as heroin. It is not as dangerous as alcohol. It is not as dangerous as tobacco. If you want to look for gateway behavior, look at third grade reading results among kids that end up using hard drugs and turning to a life of crime. We know what the risk factors are, and this bill will not do anything except make young people more resistant to messages to not use drugs.
Well, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with your conclusion, Mr. Fenneke, but I appreciate your testimony. With that, we're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 342, and we are adjourned for the afternoon committee.
Thank you, Brian.